in Ajam's Emerging Scholarship Series today. We're here with Dr. Farzina Vejdani, Assistant Professor at Ryerson University. We'll be talking to him about his new book, Making History in Iran, which was published by Stanford University Press just this year, right? A month ago?
That's right.
Yeah. It's so great to be here with you today. Just for those who are unfamiliar, if you could tell us about your work, what is the history of history in Iran? Who worked as historians? How did this change over time? You know, these classic questions about history. It's very meta.
Well, thank you, Bita. I guess where I'd start is the best way to think about the history of history is how people's understanding of the past changed over the course of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. In particular, I was interested in the emergence of modern history writing as a discipline in Iran and how individuals from a wide cross-section of Iranian society engaged in this practice. One of the things that I noticed is that you don't have professional historians writing modern histories from the get-go. It starts off with people, say, at the imperial court who translate histories from European languages into Persian. You also begin to have individuals starting up new schools who begin to write history textbooks for children and for young adults. And you also have journalists writing histories as part of, say, serialized series in newspapers or journals. So this is all to show that that history writing is not contained to just a small segment of Iran society, but there's a broader segment of society that's involved in this.
That's really interesting. You mentioned a few different types of historians or mm-hmm. people who are writing history, but aren't professional historians. Mm-hmm. Can we talk a little bit about the priorities of these historians and how these priorities changed from the late 19th to the 20th century? Because this was, for some, a very exciting period. Assassinations, revolutions, things were happening. For others, very chaotic. And how is this reflected in the history writing?
No, that's a great question. I think what I would say is that initially, history writing, modern history writing in Iran, had to do with top-down authoritarian reforms. This whole idea of enlightened despotism manifested itself in the types of histories that were translated from European languages into Persian. So in a sense, the way I understand this is that it has an earlier precedent in the Mirror for Princes literature that you see in both Persian and Islamicate kind of context. So the idea was to find an exemplary model for reform and for the king to bring about reforms in Iran. Then what you see in the early 20th century is a new emphasis on the idea of the nation. Right. And as you begin to have schools set up in Iran, modern schools, the frame through which history is understood is the frame of the nation. So it's no longer about the kings. It's not a sort of Shahnameh-style narrative. It's more about the Iranian nation and the Iranian people. Once you get to the Constitutional Revolution, this has political connotations as well. Then what you see in that era is that there's a constitutional endpoint for history. You read back into previous periods of Iranian history the idea of constitutionalism, even when it's not really there. But it tells you something about how that frame changes. And then finally, with the emergence of Reza Shah and the Pahlavis, there's a new set of emphasis on, once again, a centralized state, the importance of the centralized state in shaping the nation, and that too is projected into earlier periods. So there's a projection in all of these periods of what individual historians want to see in the Iranian past.
That's really interesting, and I like how you mentioned the different dynasties and the different eras they represented, because popularly there seems to be the sense that the downfall, that the Rajas represented a huge downfall, they were a dynasty of decline, and that the Pahlavis represented a sort of emergence into the modern period, and this was a clear rupture. But in your book, you show that there is a bit of continuity between the historians, between the people who are doing the history making, between these two dynasties and others. And I was wondering if you could elaborate on the continuities.
Okay, yeah, no, that's a great question. So I think that part of the problem in how things like history writing have been written about in the past, in the Iranian context, is that there's an assumption that it follows neatly with the political history. But in some ways, the impetus for some of these new forms of history writing came from the public, came from non-state realms. And so the case of education is a good one. Yes, you did have the Darul Funun being set up in the mid-19th century as kind of a state project, but by the closing years of the 19th century, you have a whole series of private initiatives to set up what were called national schools, modern schools that were kind of, the money came from private sources. So in those cases, the history writing is done by individuals that are not bound by the state in the same way that you would be if you were writing as part of a state school. So in that sense, the history of this modern form of education started prior to the Pahlavi state and started prior to the Constitutional Revolution. Once you do have the Constitutional Revolution in 1906, many of these educational reformers who are operating in this public kind of sphere are very supportive of the Constitutional Revolution. And so there isn't this rupture, there isn't this rejection of what came before the Constitutional Revolution. If anything, they see the Constitutional Revolution as an extension of what they had already been doing in the Muzaffari period. So in that sense, they find a way to integrate what they were doing with what happens after the Constitutional Revolution. And likewise, I see an element of integration of previous historical periods into how they talk about history. So even for the historians themselves, they don't see sharp ruptures. And that has a lot to do with nationalism. Nationalism is more, I think, about creating a sense of continuity with the past rather than stressing these major ruptures. At least that seems to have been the Iranian experience in the 20th century.
That makes a lot of sense. And you brought up the issue of education. And I wanted to move on to the issue of standardizing Iranian history, which was largely done through education. And so how did school instruction, textbooks, other sort of outreach methods, how did these contribute to standardization? And was standardization ever actually successful?
Okay, no, I guess where we could start with that question is that really, once again, you see that the idea of standardization predates slightly the rise of the Pahlavis when it really got into full swing through the Ministry of Education, but definitely the rise of Reza Khan and the establishment of the Pahlavi dynasty gave more support for standardization. And this had a lot to do with the idea of a strong central state. Iran, from the period of from the Constitutional Revolution onwards, I would argue, experienced a period of decentralization and a lot of autonomy for various elements within civil society and within the public sphere to express themselves in a number of educational means and opportunities. But really by the mid-20s, you have this idea that what's really lacking or what Iran really needs is standardized education and new opportunities for people to go through a school system. So as part of that, you have manuals for teachers about how to teach history in the classroom. You have almost developmentalist ideas about how history should be taught for students of a particular age and how that sort of changes. And the question of how successful it was is an interesting one. It's very difficult to get at. On the surface, I think it was a success insofar as you see more professionalization of teaching. So now you have to have some sort of a diploma, really, by the 1930s for the most part, to be a teacher in a school, while in previous periods you could have, say, a purely religious education, but just an interest in modern historical topics and still be a teacher. So there's a level of professionalization that occurs there. And with the establishment of the University of Tehran in the 1930s, you also begin to see the emergence of the professional historian. So you have a new category of a professional historian emerging who's engaged in research. And this, too, is part of that broader process of standardization. And perhaps more in the realm of ideology, you also begin to have propaganda institutions being set up. And so the state is using that as a way to reach out to the public and enforce a standardized notion of what it means to be Iranian and what the Iranian past should mean to them.
That's really interesting, what the Iranian past should mean to them, because my own research on slavery and race in Iran deals with, you know, the erasure of certain histories to accommodate a modern, a progressive, at least progressive sounding history. And I'm sure with the standardization, there must have, I mean, you have to erase something. And so I was wondering what sorts of erasures you found in your research.
Well, there were many erasures, in especially the standardized textbooks of Iran from the early 20th century to about the mid-20th century. And this is on many different levels. Oftentimes, religious minorities are not mentioned at all. You have very little discussion of, say, Iranian Jews or Iranian Christians. Zoroastrians, of course, are a bit of a special case. They were sometimes brought in for nationalist purposes. But even how that's done, I think, is significant, because Zoroastrianism, the type of Zoroastrianism that's promoted, is an orthodox Zoroastrianism. That's the Zoroastrianism that's talked about, not the heterodox forms. So, for example, the Mazdakites, when they're discussed in a lot of these textbooks, are disparaged and looked down upon as a source of disunity in Iranian history. So that's an example of a bit of ambiguity, even in the case of the Zoroastrians. Babis and Baha'is are similarly kind of erased in some of these narratives, or talked about in terms of heterodoxy and as a challenge to the unity of the Iranian nation. And moreover, there's many erasures in terms of gender. So one thing that really stands out is that women are almost completely absent from the standardized historical narratives. It is a very male-centered history.
Yeah, and you have a chapter on the women's press, which, you know, was a lively press, especially during the early 20th century. And I was wondering if you could talk about the internationalism of women's citizenship, how they would look outward to people like Khalida Adib or, I don't know, their American or British counterparts or who else. What was that like?
Yeah, I think one of the things to point out about the women's press is that the women's movement in Iran in this period of, say, the 1920s, the space they found to present women's history was not in the standardized school textbooks of say, the state, but it's through the press. So in a sense, it's coming out of the public sphere that exists and the autonomy that they had through their voluntary associations. And it's through there that they present women's history. And almost the literary form that it takes, because all history has this literary dimension to it, is the biography and the serialized biography. So you see women's histories being presented as serialized biographies in the women's press, which again is not really talked about. The assumption is that there's an erasure and no one was really writing about women, but in fact women were writing about themselves in a sense through the press, and the internationalism that we see in the women's press is that They do talk about their counterparts in Europe and in America and in developments that are occurring there. But what's also quite fascinating is that the majority, I feel, the majority of biographies that they decide to write are about, quote-unquote, Eastern women and sometimes Muslim women in particular. So there's almost a more regional flair to the women's press that suggests that, unlike their male counterparts that were kind of seeing history as being primarily a national kind of discipline or approach to the past, they had a broader perspective. They had a broader regional perspective. And part of the reason why I think Muslim women were brought in so much in this press is that they, like other historians writing in other periods, were seeking analogies. They were trying to understand how women in other contexts could, for example, be involved in politics. And so Khalida Adib is a good example of a very prominent sort of individual involved in politics. And so they drew inspiration from those types of stories and thought about how telling these stories would inspire women in Iran to take on similar sorts of struggles.
So continuing this sort of internationalist framework, throughout different points in your book, you mentioned various foreigners from the Arab Christian, or some would say Ottoman Arab Christian, Georgi Zaidan, to the British E.G. Brown. And what role did these foreigners and their understanding of history affect, for lack of a better term, an indigenous approach in Iran?
I think one thing we should sort of say from the outset is that Iranians weren't slavishly imitating foreigners when they were writing histories. They definitely were aware of these new developments, but they engaged with foreign authors on their own terms. And what is quite fascinating about both the examples that you mentioned, Georgi Zaidan and E.G. Brown, is that the choice of these figures is, I think, quite strategic, because one of the things that comes through in Georgi Zaidan's history of Islamic civilization is a very positive reading of the role of, say, the Iranians or Persians in Abbasid history. E.G. Brown similarly had a very positive view of Persian literature and of more specifically Iranian Persian literary history. Right. So the choice of appropriating these figures is not just kind of a blind imitation, but it's a way of reinforcing tendencies that already exist. And it's also a way of writing to a specific domestic audience. In many ways, this parallels translations that you see occurring that I talked about, for example, the top-down modernizing reform. So we really have to understand who is the audience for the writing of history, and how does this affect what is being written?
So how does the autonomy of the historian affect what was being written? As a historian yourself, I also identify as a historian. What does autonomy mean for the history writing in Iran?
I think it's really at the crux of the sorts of issues that a historian faces in the course of their career. If your entire livelihood depends on a state that is enforcing a particular narrative, you will have very little wiggle room in terms of what you can and can't say. But there are periods of history in which there are new opportunities, right? Whether it's to some extent under Muzaffar ad-Din Shah, the opening of these new private schools and the allowing of certain constitutional ideas to creep into Iranian history textbooks, or later periods during the Constitutional Revolution, when you have essentially new patrons of history that are not directly tied to the state, that commission historians to write history as they see fit. This allows the historian to experiment. Some of the most experimental forms of history that we see are from the constitutional period. Some of them are written in verse and are written in this kind of didactic form. And they promote very different pro-constitutionalist narratives, quite a wide range of pro-constitutionalist narratives. So this suggests that in these periods of decentralization, of perhaps the weakening of the state, you also have an amazing opportunity for historians to be experimental, to be creative, and to come up with new historical narratives. But at the same time, and this is the flip side of this issue, is if you don't have a way of making a sustained livelihood, then even in these periods of decentralization, you might not be able to continue writing histories. So there's this paradox that emerges in the Pahlavi period, which is that you have more schools, you have more state funding for schools, which allows more historians to be writing, but they're writing in a context where their opportunities for expressing themselves are curtailed. So that's, I think, one of the central paradoxes that we see in this period. And I talk a lot about Abbas Iqbal, who came from a sort of lower socioeconomic status, and the pressures that he feels in the Pahlavi period to write particular forms of history. Of course, this wasn't something that I could talk about in the book, but by the 1940s, he's very critical of Reza Shah and of the Pahlavis. So you see that even he's not naive in what he's writing. He's very aware of the types of pressures that he's under in these periods.
That was really fascinating. And I just wanted to thank you on behalf of Ajam for giving us this opportunity today. It was really lovely to have you.
Thank you for this opportunity. Thank you.